Hello, Wiretappers. I'm back from my summer hiatus. I completed my Bonnie and Clyde tour on motorcycles with my good friend Kate Kozel. I have edited those videos into a YouTube series on Bonnie and Clyde, and now I'm back with the mob story right out of our favorite city, Chicago, Illinois. So let's get on with the show.
You are listening to Gangland Wire, hosted by former Kansas City Police Intelligence Unit Detective Gary Jenkins.
Well, welcome all you wiretappers out there. Welcome to the studio of Gangland Wire. I'm here with my good friend, Camulus Robinson. Cam, how you doing tonight?
Gary, I'm great. I'm glad we got a little story going on, and I'm happy to be here.
Well, folks, first of all, don't forget to use your Venmo app and buy me a cup of coffee or a shot and a beer if you want. It's Gangland Wire's the code. I'd like to thank a couple of people for giving me a nice little donations, and you've got some stuff on the way. At least one person does, for sure. You know, if you give me enough money, get up around $25, I send you a copy of my DVD with all the special features on it, including the really interesting interview with the Las Vegas Metro Intelligence Commander, who once bought a plane ticket and went to Chicago, went to Alan Dorfman's office after he visited Joey Iuppa's house and Tony Accardo's house, and nobody was there. And he told Alan Dorfman, says, "You tell these guys that if they don't lift the contract on my two policemen out there, why, I'm going to come back with a whole bunch of men and kill everybody around those houses." Now, believe it or not, that guy told me that story right out of his own lips, Cam. And it's on the special features, the whole story in great detail. So if y'all know why they wanted to kill a couple of Las Vegas Metro Intelligence coppers, why, get the DVD and you can get the special features and see that interview. I want to thank Mike McCollum. I know you've got it. You should have your DVD by now. I really appreciate it. Nice donation through my website on PayPal. Also, my Venmo app, Mark Ryan, a regular contributor. Thanks a lot, Mark. It's about time for me to send you something. I don't know if I have or not. I need to go back and I have to get an address on you. Thomas Price, and you know, you'll like this, Thomas. Cam, you'll like this. Thomas Price said, "Great episodes. I really like the ones with Cam in them." So there you go. Is that your brother-in-law?
I appreciate it. That means a lot.
Yeah, really. I know what you mean. It kind of makes it all worthwhile, doesn't it?
Absolutely. Absolutely. That's a hell of a compliment.
Because we don't really do this for the money, folks. We do it more for the love of the history and sharing the history with you guys out there. But we need a little money every once in a while to keep the hosting company paid and keep the website up and buy some new equipment. Cam just bought a new microphone for his, so the sound on the podcast will be a little bit better. We're also simultaneously doing a Skype, so if you can't get this on the podcast and you're on my YouTube channel, this will be up on the YouTube channel here pretty soon. Let's get on with the story. Cam got hold of me the other day, and he had seen this article in the Chicago Tribune, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was a Tribune.
About a modern-day outfit dude that's in trouble again. Matter of fact, did he cop a plea? I can't remember now. I have to look back.
Yeah, he did. He did. He took a plea for one case of extortion. He had 10 felonies against him. Agreed to take one case of extortion, and rather than fight it, they took the deal.
You know, back in the day, they'd have been out killing witnesses like crazy and then going to trial. But, you know, this is a modern times. We have the same thing in Kansas City, Cam. Last case we had, one of the bookies just told his bettors, he said, "You know, just you go tell the G anything they want to know, and we're going to all cop pleas," which they did immediately. So that's the modern mob.
Yeah, yeah. Absolutely. Well, shit, they got to worry about prosecutions now. That was back in the day. They when you own the courts and you own the cops and half of them anyway.
You fought it all the way. Right. They owned a lot of the cops and almost all the courts. The only people they didn't own were just a few cops and the feds, of course.
Yeah, right, the feds.
Well, this guy was John Pudgy Matassa Jr. Would you say that was correct pronunciation?
Pudgy Matassa.
Pudgy Matassa. He was a capo of the Northside Rush Street crew. He was the son of a Chicago police officer, which is kind of interesting. I tell you what, that Chicago PD, I mean, if you got any Chicago coppers out there, don't get mad at me, but boy, you had some guys that were hand in glove with the outfit up there. We had a couple down here, but you had even more up there.
Yeah, there's rumors about Pudgy's old man and Sam Giancana, but you know, there's a lot of rumors all over Chicago.
Yeah, there always is. So let's talk a little bit about the Rush Street crew. I've heard of them, and I believe there was Vincent Solano was kind of the most recent boss, wasn't he?
Yeah, he was. He's part of that that famous Last Supper photo. He's, if you're looking at the photo, he's the third guy from the left, smiling there next to Dominic DiBella, and he's wearing an orange shirt. He goes back a long way, Solano, Innocent Vince Solano. He took over after Ross Prio, who was old-time guy back in Capone's day. And Solano was his driver, and you know that the driver is usually a position of prestige, so that gets you in.
Oh yeah, that's how Nick Savella. He was Tony Gizzo's driver, and when Tony Gizzo died, he was the next boss. So that's usually being right next to the man for a while. Kind of works that way on the police department. You get up next to the man, next thing you know, you are the man.
That's so right.
That's how it works. You know, Rush Street, I've heard of Rush Street, and there used to be a lot of clubs on Rush Street, so there's a lot of opportunity for vice activities. Anytime you got a lot of liquor establishment, there's a lot of opportunities for vice activities and other things that the mob likes to get involved in. Let's talk a little bit about what you remember about Rush Street and how they made money off of Rush Street.
Well, you would compare it to Times Square, I guess, in New York at the time. It was a lot of clubs, a lot of entertainment. Prostitution was rumored to take place in the entertainment district. But, of course, they did their loan sharking and their gambling. But when you're going door-to-door extorting these clubs and porn shops, again, we got the porn shops. And a lot of times what we find is they preyed on the gay clubs and different things because in the 70s, that was 60s and 70s, that was easy. Those were easy marks. And so there was a lot of focus by a lot of these guys on a lot of the gay clubs, all the porn shops. Your guy, Red Wimette was dealing with the Northside crew. They were using Frank Shui as a collector, but he was kicking up to Solano. Ken Ito ran gambling. There was a lot of gambling. Ken Ito was kicking up to the north side. And it was actually on Vince Solano's orders that Ito was the attempted murder of Ito by two north side members. The larger image is the north side crew, and the Rush Street district is really where they made a lot of their money.
Interesting. Now, to kind of let people know, Ken Ito was a Japanese guy. He was a Japanese-American. Who spent actually a little bit of time in the internment camps during the war, and he came up to Chicago afterwards, and he got into Bolito, or the numbers game, and he built a hell of a business running numbers and doing other gambling activities, but primarily numbers, and he was making a lot of money for him, and they got nervous about him. Vince Solano, who he was working for and under, they got real nervous about him, and he sent a couple of his guys over to Jasper Campese and John Catuso. Yeah, he sent them over to kill him, and they screwed it up. And they shot him in the head, but their loads didn't go in well enough to kill him. And he ended up going to witness protection program. Those two guys ended up dead in the trunks of their car shortly thereafter. Ken Ito then was a traveling. He came down to Kansas City during the skim trials. Did you know that, Cam?
I didn't know that. I knew he was an expert witness for a while, but
He came down to Kansas City and identified everybody in that Last Supper picture, and right? told the jury, said, "This is so and so. This is who this is, and this who answers to who, and this is how the mob works, or the outfit in Chicago works," in order to prove to the jury that this was a mafia case. Why, a guy like that. was invaluable. Jimmy Fratiano came into Kansas City and testified as to how the mafia works, and that's devastating to a defendant.
Absolutely
devastating. So anyhow, that's a little bit about the Northside Crew and how they made their money. They did. I see you got something about this casino type gambling operation out of the Grand Plaza Hotel. That sounds kind of interesting.
Right, they had a whole casino set up, and different members of the they split up the tables between different members. Matassa owned a couple tables actually with Jasper Campisi. They split the income from a couple tables, but it was in the Grand Hotel. It was basically an entire casino set up in downtown Chicago. So they were making quite a bit of money there, and you know to run that kind of an operation basically out of a hotel, several rooms, to have a known casino, you've got to have a couple friends in politics and law enforcement.
Oh yeah, several of them. To a lot of people in law enforcement, gambling is not dirty money.
Yeah,
narcotics is dirty money. Gambling is not dirty money. Gambling, a lot of their friends and relatives may want to frequent that casino, because back then you couldn't just go to an Indian casino right outside of town. There weren't any casinos. You had to go clear to Las Vegas or Atlantic City. So having a local casino was kind of a boon.
Chicago actually enforced their, speaking to your point about narcotics, Chicago was actually pretty hardcore about their anti-drug stance. Paul Rica's son was an addict, and he drew the line. And there were a number of cases of guys who tried to dabble in it, like you see more in New York and different places. And Chicago whacked them out. They killed them. One guy, I think we've talked about before, I can't remember his name off the top of my head. He went to jail for a while, and as soon as he got out, the day he got out, I had the Wild Bunch kill him in front of his wife and kids. They waited until after he got out of prison, and then they took him out.
Oh, yeah, I remember that. Yeah, we're the same way in Kansas City. There was no direct involvement in any narcotics at all. It was like a death penalty. There was indirect, right. there was indirect involvement. You could loan money at loan shark rates to somebody who was making money off of drugs, but you did not participate in that directly yourself until the 90s, and then some of the younger guys started getting involved. And just like Nick knew was going to happen, law enforcement took them all off, and one of our main guys named Willie Camisano, his grandson, ended up getting popped for dealing a whole key of cocaine. He did about 7 or 8 years, and I think he got a 10-year sentence. Did about 7 years of it. So he tried to tell them, don't be messing with that stuff, because law enforcement's all over it, and there's draconian sentences for messing with it.
We look even at this case that we're about to get into, Matassa, with all this money he was taking from a union and scamming the Social Security Administration, he still only copped a plea for 6 months and 6 months home arrest. So compared to the sentences for drugs, it just wasn't there.
It's just not there. Yeah. Speaking of that, I noticed one other name you've got, Joseph DeVarco. DeVarco is a guy whose house they served a search warrant on. I think IRS served a search warrant on it. And they're the ones, that's where they found the Last Supper pictures, what Red Womette told me. And I believe I was able to verify that. So kind of interesting, because that picture came back to haunt him many times over. When you got a storyteller like Ken Ito or Tokyo Joe, as they called him, pointing each one of them, say, this is this guy, this is that guy, and this is who answers to who. And why, that's devastating.
Mm-hmm.
So Vincent Solano, he kind of started this whole labor union racketeering thing. It seemed like he was the guy. He was a business agent for a labor union up there in Chicago.
Absolutely, and these guys have to have some sort of legitimate income to justify their criminal income. So they show something to the IRS. And Solano was head of the local number one for the laborers union. Labor's International Union of North America, LIUNA, and he was in control for years. He was the president, business agent, and he really, really ran that union until he died, and then Matassa took over for him as head of the council in Chicago. You figure there were at the time, say, 47,000 national members of the laborers union, and 19,000 to 20,000 of them were in Chicago alone. So this was your center of power for that union.
Wow, that's it wasn't quite the International Brotherhood of Teamsters, but it was it had quite a few members. So that's a pretty good size pension plan, a pretty good size budget that they
paid the rent.
Yeah, really. So what happened, I guess, with Matassa, let's talk a little bit about his union history then, because this is a different union that he becomes president of.
Right. Which, he was thrown out of that the laborers union, and he fought it for years. I found a lot of the government papers on it, and a lot of the other mob guys, there were several members in, and they had all packed up and gone home. But Matassa was not about to give it up. He joined the union in, it was 1980, I believe, and he rose through the ranks pretty quick. 85 is when he joined, and he rose through the ranks, business agent, delegate for, he was local number two, and Solano was local number one. But once Solano died, he took over as president and co-coordinator of committees, which gave him access to the pension fund. And he fought it and fought it for years. They said guy said he's like a cat holding onto the carpet. He's not going to let go. What was odd though is when he was forced out in '98. A lot of times you see guys like Hoffa and some of the Teamsters guys are banned from future labor activities, from future involvement in labor. That didn't happen with Matassa. In 1998, he was thrown out of the laborers. And in 2000, he figured he'd start his own union.
Wow. And I see in your notes here that the laborers union had failed to hold contested elections for 25 years.
Right.
Yeah. We just rubber stamp the same people in, or whoever the next person is. If somebody else dies, they just put another person in and just say, you know, that we don't need to have anybody run against him.
And that's kind of like the Teamsters were for so long. They were nominated by members of the council. You had Hoffa, and then you had Fitzgerald, and then a run through until you get Roy Williams.
Riley Williams, yeah.
And then Jackie Presser. It was just basically a rubber stamp. What the members had to say, supposedly they were talking to their members of the council, and then they were voting them in. But it was really just a bunch of deals between the mob families, and there were no general elections in the Teamsters, and you see that a lot during these unions in the 50s, 60s, and 70s where they were mobbed up.
Yeah, I've seen some conversations at Alan Dorfman's office where they were talking about Roy Lee Williams and how it was just, you know, he was going to be the next guy, you know. Mm-hmm. They didn't talk like there was going to be an election. They just talked like he was going to be the next guy.
Right. That was the deal. Kansas City, it was their turn. They made their backroom deals. Just like later with Jackie Presser, Cleveland made their deals. They swore up and down he would be a good one. Chicago was against it, but the Genovese reached out, and Tony Salerno reached out and said, you know, the guy's okay. And of course, Jackie Presser became a federal, had been a high echelon informer basically his entire career.
Yeah, that's it. I tell you what, it's crazy sometimes, isn't it? He had been a top echelon informant for a long time, and then they exposed him because he seemed like he subverted a couple of FBI agents somehow. I can't remember exactly the whole story, but he got them wrapped up into something. So there was a court case, and it had to come out that
over some no-show jobs, over a couple no-show positions, and he fought it, and finally they exposed him.
And it wasn't that big a deal, but
no.
Oh well, yeah, they get greedy.
Yeah, it becomes a measuring contest.
So you got a few fun facts down here about old Pudgy Matassa. Let's tell the folks a little bit of some of these fun facts about Pudge here.
He was introduced by his uncle, Mike Glitta, the spark plug a couple people call him, but he was introduced around, so he had a good connection getting in, and Pudgy. He was a relatively young guy for what you consider the outfit now. He was, even when they busted him, now he's 67, I believe, so he started out as a young guy, an up-and-comer. He was part of that. There was a lot of talk in the Family Secrets trial from Nick Calabrese that there was a making ceremony, which was really not done in Chicago. But in 83 or 85, I've read different things, they did have a formal ceremony to induct new members. But on the list of people that Nick Calabrese list as being there, Iuppa was overseeing it, but Accardo was not. And with Accardo being Sicilian, you'd think if this were something that he cared about, that was important to him, he used to speak disparagingly about New York. And I've read that Ferriola or somebody, maybe Iuppa, but doubtful because he had been in charge for so long, but they decided they wanted the more formal ceremonies. So a lot of these guys who are making news now or within the last few years, Sal De Laurentiis and Mike Sarno, and you've got Matassa and the Calabrese brothers, they were all made around the same time in this ceremony. So it was unusual, but they did it in the 80s, and a lot of those guys have gone on.
Yeah, it wouldn't have been Iuppa, probably. It had to be after Iuppa, because so. Iuppa was down here in Kansas City doing the skim trials in 83, and he was pretty well gone by then. Well, probably during that time, he was probably not making many decisions, I would imagine.
It was Infelice or Ferriola is what I've read, different accounts.
Interesting. I see that he got something about talking about police, KC or Chicago PD TAC unit friend of Matassa doing raids to set up other gamblers in opposition or in competition with Kid Ito.
Yeah, I think that was a give and take. He had a buddy on the tactical unit, and he said, "Well, you know, you watch my back, and I'll give you a few busts every once in a while." And I would imagine that the guys they took out were not paying the street tax at the time. So that was, they didn't have to kill them all. They had connections in law enforcement, and if it would help you look good, you could turn over and say, you know, if you want to go to diversity, then you can pick up a couple guys running a card game. And that was what they did.
Well, I'll tell you what, that's probably not the only place that happened. I always felt sometimes that somebody would give me some information. It might have been taking out the competition as much as anything. Now, I wasn't taking bribes or anything, but, you know, you go with what you got. So
maybe they just wanted to do the right thing. That was
all. Yeah,
conscience,
I'm sure.
Was getting heavy, every once in a while.
Well, it's a crazy game, but somebody's got to play it.
A couple years later, Matassa was the guy when Nick Calabrese was speaking to the Fed, and he was the witness in the family secrets. They involved a U.S. Marshal, a guy named John Ambrose, in trying to locate Calabrese to try and take him out before he gave testimony. And it was Matassa who was the frontline dealer with this guy Ambrose. But when that all came down, they didn't really have the evidence against Matassa, but they did have John Ambrose. So they found out where Calabrese was staying on the orders of Jimmy Marcello, and it was Matassa who put that whole deal together. So that was kind of an interesting side note. There are a lot of historical events that we know of now that Matassa was a key figure, but he really didn't have a criminal record. He's a relatively smart guy until this bust came up.
Interesting. That whole, I remember that locating Nick Calabrese and that U.S. Marshal that they somehow co-opted. That was, that's the kind of the cardinal rule is with witnesses in U.S. Marshal's program is witness protection, WITSEC, as they call it. That's really tough to penetrate that. So I don't know what they had on that marshal, but they must have had something. Yeah, looked like they tried to bribe him. Did he take the bribe? Do you remember?
I can't remember. I've read about bribes, and I've not really looked into it too heavily, and that was a little bit before my time when I moved up here. But I know that they likely had something on him because he was supposedly a clean-nosed guy, but you're not a U.S. Marshal giving away information on one of the top witnesses in the entire country for no reason.
Yeah, that was and that was one of the top witnesses in the entire country at that time. There was nothing like that before. Even the skim trials were different. There was a couple of witnesses in that, and they kept them protected. But it's not like the internal in Chicago kind of a thing. This was more broad-based. Several cities were involved, and they were really, that Family Secrets trial, they were going to take down Chicago, it looked to me like.
New York had people come forward and had been informing basically the whole time. Chicago, until Nick Calabrese, they were really just some minor guys, Jehoda and a couple, but Calabrese was the first major juiced informant in Chicago, and that trial came out in 2007. The New York Commission trial was in the early 80s, 80, 81, 82.
I always found that interesting. My FBI agent friend, Bill Housley, I used to work with, pointed out that Kansas City never had a top mob guy come in and testify.
No shit.
And he put it down to the fact that Kansas City is a small town, and I'll testify to this. Mm-hmm. We're such a small town that if you come in and testify and you have any kind of extended family, you go out into witness protection, but you leave your whole extended family behind, and they are all intermarried with or, you know, second cousins or go to weddings and funerals and stuff with other extended family members of mob people. So they're all painted with the same brush of, you know, you being the rat or the informant. And so they're persona non grata in a huge kind of their normal social group. I play golf with a guy who's a retired copper, Italian guy. And, you know, one of his sons marries a girl from a family whose uncle was a mob bookmaker who was killed. And so, you know, you just, you know, it's such a small town, they can't get away from it. So he thinks that's why nobody ever came in, because it would have been so devastating for such a huge bunch of people that were out of their extended family.
That's an interesting point. That does make a lot of sense, though.
Yeah, you say, like, New York City is such a huge city that, you know, people are not going to be quite so close together.
Right.
Or even Chicago is a pretty good-sized city, although it's smaller than Kansas. I mean, smaller than New York, and it's more like Kansas City. It's just Kansas City on steroids. But you got a lot of people that, you know, gravitated out to the suburbs already in Chicago, and they're so far from the inner city or the where it all started, Little Italy. But in Kansas City, you don't get that far away. I don't care how far out in the suburbs you go, you don't get that far away. So, Camp, tell me a little bit about this union that our friend Pudgy Matassa got in trouble for. Kind of interesting what you found out about the International Union of Amalgamated Workers Local 7-Eleven. You said there are 150 employees in that
between
union.
Wisconsin, Indiana, and Illinois, he had about 100 total. 100 total members, and we be careful what we don't say too much. They are still around.
they're still around. They're still a union. Food service workers, roofers, construction workers.
Anybody who was looking to join a union, basically, Matassa would take them in, and as long as they would pay their dues, he would provide them with superior representation, as well as supporting his entire lifestyle from the coffers of the union, and also paying himself an enormous paycheck.
And plus his wife, she filled an instrumental part in that union, didn't she?
You know, I wasn't sure if she was even aware of it, because she may have known on the periphery, but basically Matassa, as we're going to get into, he set her up as a ghost employee, and he was in charge of taking the minutes of the meeting, so he just altered the minutes of the meeting to show that the board members had voted her in. A lot of these people who they later questioned said, I didn't even realize I was a board member. I didn't know I was a trustee. So the whole upper echelon was totally structured by Matassa, and he was basically writing his wife the checks and signing her name and depositing them. Her role, if anything, was basically as a loving spouse, and he was signing her checks and depositing them. So
interesting. You know, one thing I found on this union is it's so interesting. There was a concrete contractor out there called probably have to be careful here. He already sued somebody for he sued the Bricklayers Union for defamation. Quality Restorations Incorporated. So now, Mr. Quality Restorations Incorporated, Mr. Joyce, who owns this little private corporation, I'm just reporting what I read in the news. But the International Union of Bricklayers and Allied Craft Workers were protesting at a construction site, and they were handing out flyers, and they alleged that that this guy, the Quality Restorations, was doing business with our friend's union, what was the name of that union?
International Union of Amalgamated Workers.
All right, number 711, which is interesting, 711. I think that was Joey Iupa's license plate number. He had a personalized license plate number back in the day that was 711 because he was a big gambler. Anyhow, I digress.
Oh, shit, I didn't even think about
So these flyers at one of Quality Restoration's sites said that they were dealing with and signed a contract with the Independent Union of Amalgamated Workers Local 711, and said that that union negotiates sweetheart contracts that mean substandard wages with little or no benefits. And they stated that the local 711 was affiliated with the Chicago mob through two men, James Bertino and John Matassa, our friend Pudge. So the concrete contractor, Quality Restorations, then filed a lawsuit against the Union of Bricklayers for defamation, because they said a lot of their potential clients saw that and, you know, tried to paint them with a Bob brush and all that kind of thing. So I don't know whatever happened with the lawsuit particularly. It's not important, but it's just like this is how other unions saw the local number 711 in Chicago. They saw them as a mob union, and they probably were not negotiating the best contracts. And another interesting thing about this contractor, Quality Restorations Incorporated, that filed this lawsuit against the Bricklayers, I just looked them up and did a Google map at their address, and it's on Taylor Street, of all places, just a little bit west of what it would be identified as Little Italy in Chicago. And their actual address, it looks like just on the Google Maps, is like an empty site with some construction equipment, construction stuff, just laying there on the ground. So I don't know. They got a hell of a website that looks good on the first page, but you click the links and there's nothing. The links all go to what we call a 404 page. There's nothing there.
I also was wondering, when you Google the International Union of Amalgamated Workers, and I don't mean to cast aspersions, I could be totally wrong, but I wondered to what extent Matassa was going around asking people if they wanted to join the UAW, and which is, you know, union, much more powerful union, just tacking on international in front of it. So it's UAW. Just we're an international UAW. You can't find much information on it. And I think that the way Matassa structured everything, I wouldn't be surprised if he was playing on the last three letters of UAW.
That makes sense. You know, and as I tell you what, union guys out there, don't get mad at me, but I was once talking to a Teamster here in Kansas City, and so I started asking him about the organized crime influence, and he got mad, and I knew the guy. He was a regular worker. He didn't have anything to do with the mob or anything, but he got madder than hell, and he said, those are just rumors that the government dreams up because we're getting too good of contracts, and so they try to slam us by saying that we're connected to the mob. Of course, wasn't within about 3 or 4 years after that that the UAW here, UAW local 711 ended up, or no, did they go into trusteeship? the other one, Vince Solano's went into trusteeship.
Solano's went into trusteeship, yeah.
And took it away from him. Well, the same thing happened to the Teamsters Union. It went into trusteeship, and they took it away from them and forced them to have real elections and totally changed the Teamsters Union. Right. Of course, the poor Teamsters, the trucking industry changed rapidly over the next few years. And Teamsters they're lucky to even still have jobs today with these self-driving trucks that are about to hit the road. So who knows where that'll happen. I hate to say it, but the unions seem like they're almost a thing of the past anymore. I was a union guy at the Ford plant, and I understand the need for that, but it's got to be legitimately run.
You know, even in Australia, they had the painters and dockers. They called them the dockies, and that union ended up being disintegrated basically by the Australian government, because you look up the painters and dockers, every major criminal throughout Australia in Sydney and Melbourne were all members of the painters and dockers union, and it was so corrupt that the government had it disbanded and allowed for several small unions to be put together. So there is it's not just America, and I don't even want to get into what the hell's going on in Europe with their union situation, but we see a lot of this activity. Anytime you are exercising control over a section of the market, you've got predators like the mob. They're going to seek it out. And I know a lot of union guys up here, and they're hard workers, and they're looking for protection as far as workers' rights protection. But you've got people who are going to prey on situations like that. So it's not so much the individual union members as it is the sharks swimming around in the water and see a situation they can capitalize on.
Right. And they'll throw out those rumors pits the government against the union and mm-hmm. say,
absolutely,
you know, we're just protecting you guys and the government's after you. That's a pretty easy rumor to float out there and take advantage of. Well, anyhow, tell us a little bit about, I know you went kind of more into this case that our friend Pudge Matassa got convicted for. Tell us a little bit how that scheme worked.
So from about 2000 to 2013, Matassa was running the union as his own little fiefdom. And he was born in 51, so by 2013, he was eligible for early Social Security retirement. But in order to qualify, your income, your reported income, can be no higher than $15,120, I believe it is. So Matassa, wanting to capitalize on the Social Security income that he feels he is owed, he sets up a plan. He puts his wife as a ghost, as a no-show employee, and the salary that he is receiving, he then transfers. Let's say he was making Let's say he's making $115,000 from the union, $215,000, whatever it is. So he transfers. He then hires his wife on, forges the board paperwork, transfers her, so she is now making $200,000, and he reported his income as $15,120, thereby qualifying him for Social Security early retirement.
So he started drawing his full Social Security at age 62.
And he contacted the Social Security in February of 2013. He gave his wife a no-show job. And then in April 30th of 2013, he submitted the application for old age early retirement to the SSA, reporting his income as $15,000 because she is now making the $200,000 or whatever have you. These are numbers that I'm making up, but $15,000 is the actual number. I'm just so bad at math that I just add a couple hundred thousand on it, and we'll go with that. So he had his first check in July of 2013. Here's where he really got in trouble. In July of 2013, he had the government wire the funds into his account. So now he has stepped up into wire fraud. So defrauding the government out of $1,100 a month. So he got really damn greedy just for an extra $1,100 a month from the Fed. But he is now having checks wired. He had two different checks throughout the years wired into his account. It was $1,659. So over the course of 2013 to I believe it was 2015 when he finally got caught, his wife is getting periodic raises from to her paycheck from the union as they gain more workers. And he is making his drawing his $15,000 plus the extra $1,600 a month from the government. So, and as her his wife's paychecks, Matassa's picking them up, signing her name, and depositing them into her account. So that's, I don't know that she had anything to do with it, because Matassa was just getting her checks himself, filling, you know, signing, endorsing them, and depositing them. And he's taking in his $1,600 a month from the government and his $15,000 salary from the union. So he was squeezing every penny that he could out of the union in his own name and his wife. And throughout the entire course of his actions, the union is paying all his expenses. They're paying for his car. They're paying for his cell phone. They're paying for most everything. I don't know if he set him up to pay his damn mortgage, but... He is using the union and the government for every damn cent he can get.
Yeah, interesting. You know, I looked at the charging papers. It looked like his total that they charged him with wasn't as much as he got. They only charged him with a total of $3,291 stealing from the Social Security, and then $2,959 from the union funds, the embezzlement of union funds, right. Which is probably why he didn't get any more than 6 months that when you go in and they don't charge you with it with the full extent of the crime.
And I think when they brought in the forensic accountants, it really wasn't worth it to them. You're looking at 15 years of fraud, and they're only coming up with $2,000 that he was embezzling from the union. I think it just, with Matassa having kept all the records, they were only able to glean together about $2,000 that he had misspent. He was not a dumb guy. He put together this whole union himself. He structured the entire pension system and retirement system. He went after the extra money from the government. He planned ahead and started his wife taking over his paycheck. It was not a dumb scam, but he would have been fine if he hadn't gone for the extra $1,600 a month in early retirement from Social Security. If he had just continued living off his union income, he would have been fine. But it gets so damn greedy, you got to get every cent.
Really, he could have done just what I did. I retired and started practicing law and making money, and I just didn't draw my Social Security until I was 66, and then you can make all the money you wanted. And so drew my full Social Security, and so it's just, he got greedy. You're right.
Kind of a lighter moment. I sent you. He's standing in front of the judge. He was complaining about his unfair treatment. The FBI is intimidating witnesses, and these witnesses are afraid the FBI is going to storm into their home and is forcing them to testify against him. He stands in front of the judge and he says, "I'm only standing here because my name is John Matassa." The judge, he had no real prior arrest record. He was an outfit guy, but he didn't have any crimes against him. The judge said, "What do you mean, John Matassa? You mean because the labor board is focusing on you?" And I think he realized he can't take the defense that as an Italian American he's facing criminal for the mob. This wasn't a mob trial, so he sort of changed tactic and said, "Yes, it's the labor department that's coming after me." I think he wanted to play that card that they often do about, "You're coming after me because my name ends in a vowel and I've been besmirched and associated with organized crime," but I didn't play without a criminal record, and the judge didn't really know who he was anyway. So he changed tact and said, "Yes, it's not because I'm a mobster. It's because I'm a labor official."
Well, you gotta try something, you know. I mean, I've seen many a lawyer in court make some argument that I'm thinking, well, where did that come from? But, you know, you just got to try something. I always struggle with doing something like that, making an argument in front of a judge. It was just like ludicrous, just totally ludicrous. I've seen it done many times, and I don't know.
One of the interesting things about this union is when he wrote the bylaws, the president shall have the authority to hire or terminate employees and set wages at will. In addition, he made himself the secretary treasurer, so another one of the bylaws states that all checks were to be signed by the president and Secretary Treasurer.
Oh yeah, that two signatures. I mean, you know, you got two signatures on the checks. That's how it works, isn't it?
He covered all his bases.
That prevents embezzlement. That's why they do that. Prevent embezzlement.
Yeah, he was looking out for the benefit of his members.
And members, really. I worked a school board embezzlement case once, and we went over and looked at their procedures after we kind of got all of our evidence together, because we were told that do not go to the school board until you have all your evidence gathered to make a case. Otherwise, they'll just kick everything under the rug. And so we kind of had everything together, and we go over there and we start looking at their procedures and talking to the supervisor over this lady who had embezzled all this money. And we found out that there was no other signature needed to be done. She had access. She could write checks for basically as big as she wanted to. She was pretty modest in what she took. She could have gotten even more. It was, I don't know, $100,000+, but there was absolutely no other signature and no other approval needed to be made for her to sign a check. So she was just making them out to her husband, who was then taking them to a friendly bank teller, that a friend of theirs that they knew, and he was just cashing them for cash, you know, like $10,000, $12,000, $8,000. I think they kept them under 10 to keep it under the CTR thing, but there was a bunch of them. Matter of fact, that's how we got into it. The husband got nervous, and they split up, and he had been a drug addict, and he got in recovery, and he started having a guilty conscience. Also, he talked to his sponsor, and his sponsor said, you know, dude, you better get in and be the first one in on this deal, because if this falls down, you're part of it. So he made the case for us because he wanted to clear his conscience and save himself in the future, because he got into recovery from addiction.
You know, these embezzlements, national, this nature of crime is billions of dollars, so much money.
It's huge.
Nationwide, and they only prosecute, I don't know, it's in the single digits, the number of people who get caught. I remember in Illinois, a little town called Dixon, there was a town auditor named Rita Crundwell. This is recent, through 2012. She, from this tiny little town, it's just a little place, over the course of several years, she embezzled $53 million.
Oh my God! She must have been a gambler. Oh, I bet it all went. I bet it all went to the casinos.
It was horses. That was her
horses,
thing.
Okay, all right.
She had gambling. 53 or 50. No, not gambling on the horses.
Oh,
she was the show horses.
Oh really? Are you kidding me?
Oh my God! She's known nationwide as one of the top breeders. She'd do the little shows. She was nationally known, nationally famous, and she had a huge house. She had a huge ranch. She had you're talking 50 or 60 horses she owned all over the state. She owned her own stables. They sold all the horses, and they ended up recouping, hell, I don't know, $9 or $10 million of it. It was quite a bit of money. But if you look up Rita Crundwell, there's a documentary about her. You would not believe the damn money this woman took. In the two town, Dixon was one of the towns. The other town was operating in a several million-dollar surplus, and Dixon was constantly operating at a $10 million deficit. The roads were in terrible condition. The town was in bad shape. Well, of course, she had $53 million from a tiny little town over course of a couple of years. This embezzlement is no joke, and Matassa was right there. And if he hadn't involved the Fed, he would be fine. He would just keep taking money and that white collar crime.
Yeah, that's for sure. It's mainly what I found working embezzlements. I was a sergeant over this. We had one detective that was assigned to embezzlements. There wasn't a squad that was assigned. We had one guy that was kind of assigned to embezzlements. And we might throw another guy in there, but mainly if you had a suspect, you got him in, and they'd always confess, and then they'd always, you know, try to make some agreement to give the money back. And usually the company would say, okay, and I don't know, you know, they'd sign some kind of a contract, and he'd agreed to give the money back, and they didn't want to prosecute. Of course, I don't think they ever ended up giving all the money back. Maybe made a few payments, but mainly it's not heavily prosecuted, like you said, and even on a smaller basis all the way up to the larger basis. This guy hadn't been a mob guy. This hadn't been, might not have been prosecuted to speak of.
Yeah, there was some case recently. My wife was telling me about a guy who was scamming insurance companies for tens of millions of dollars, And they didn't prosecute, but they said, well, from now on, you're going to repay all these millions of dollars out of the payments that are current. He was a kinesiologist. He was just a personal trainer.
No, yeah.
Tens of millions of dollars. And they said, okay, out of the payments you're currently receiving from the insurance company, we're just going to dock those. And he's, well, those are scam payments anyway. And if you just,
yeah,
you want to apply my current scam towards the debt from my previous scam, okay.
Okay, yeah. That's crazy.
If you want to pay yourselves back with your own money, that's, I appreciate it.
All right. Well, this has been a great show, Cam. I appreciate you doing this research and helping me with this. And I think people will find this interesting and topical because it's going on practically
right
today in Chicago and other little labor unions throughout the United States. I tell you what, folks, if any of you guys, if you're on, you draw a pension from somebody like I get the pension from the Kansas City Police Department, and I was a member of the board, you need to pay attention to who's on that board and mm-hmm. do they have meetings and where do they have the meetings? I know there was another police department that got in trouble. The pension plan was getting in trouble, which a lot of them were after 2008 and the big recession. But they found out these guys were like having meetings in Dubai. So they were sending everybody on these extended trips to Dubai and buying themselves, you know, renting cars for themselves and doing all kinds of stuff. So pay attention to your pension boards, union members and government members and get, you know, get active. Go to the meetings once in a while. We had about three or four people that would all come to every meeting. But other than that, nobody, they just wanted their check. They just wanted to know their check was coming.
Local town councils, anything where people are in charge of any amount of money, we go right to our local. It's anytime people are presented with control over money, that's you got to keep an eye on them. Absolutely, yeah. You're exactly right, Gary.
Somebody needs to pay attention to mm-hmm. it. Although those meetings can be like watching paint dry, boring as shit.
Yeah, that's the truth.
That's one reason I got off that pension board. Okay, I've done my duty, and I know the people that are on it really well now. But it was boring as shit. I never did like it. I did my duty. I did 6 years.
You've done your time.
Really? All right. Well, Cam, it's been great talking with you again. We'll do some more of these. Folks, don't forget, we talked about a little bit about addiction earlier. If you have a friend or relative has a problem with drugs or alcohol, make your first call to First Call. Call 816-361-5900. Or go to their website, www.firstcallkc.org. And don't forget, here's my commercial announcement. I did a little one earlier. My Venmo app, make me a buy me a cup of coffee at Gangland Wire is the code on that. You can go to my website for $25 or more. I'll send you a copy of my DVD. Send me more than that, and I'll send you a copy of the book. I had a guy make a really nice donation. We won't say how much, but I sent him a copy of the book and the movie. I'll leave that up to you, whether you want to get a copy of the book. Why, you got to send more than $25. Is that fair, Cam?
Sounds all right to me. That's a hell of a documentary, so it's absolutely worth it.
And you get the book, the companion book to go with it, which I'll sign, of course. You want to take a mob tour of Kansas City without traveling to Kansas City, get my Kansas City Mob Tour app at the Apple App Store. I'm working on a new documentary about a mob war that we had in Kansas City in the 1970s. So look forward to seeing that in the future. Cam's been helping me write the script, and he's been reviewing it for me and kind of keeping me straight and helping me make the story more understandable and easy to understand, which is hard to do in a complicated mob story, isn't it, Cam?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Just putting this stuff together. These guys know what they're doing.
Yeah. All right. Good night, folks. Good night, Cam.
Night, Gary.
Music provided by our good friend and super fan from Portland, Oregon, Casey McBride. Thanks, Casey.